So some of you are going to tell me that I have no right what I'm about to say. But I'm going to say it anyway, and you're probably correct. I have started getting really weirded out by those articles online that say, do you know how old such and such cultural event is turning, and does that make you feel really old yet? Because, of course, the answer is always yes, it does. And there's one that's coming up right around now that I've been reading about recently that's very personal for me. One of the first albums that I bought with my own money back in 1991 is about to turn 30, obviously, right? So that does make me feel a little bit old, and I'm sorry if some of you say that I'm a jerk for saying that, but it does. So that album is Achtung Baby by U2, and it was recorded this year. And there's a lot of interesting stories about the background of those songs in that album, so that people are kind of revisiting it right now and saying it's, you know, 30 years between when they started to record this. And one of the things that is sort of interesting about that album in particular that connects to the series that we've been doing together as a church for the last month and a half or so about the pilgrim spirit in our faith. And so we're connecting that back also to those that are remembered as pilgrims from coming over from England through Holland and eventually to North America. We celebrate with the first Thanksgiving. This is the 400th anniversary of the folks who came over at that time. If you remember that, you are right that it makes you feel very old if you were part of that group, and it's turning 400 already. Who can believe it? How time flies. So we're looking at how that same pilgrim spirit, not only from those who we trace our congregational legacy back through, but also stories in the Bible of people who are going on pilgrimages, how that helps us learn about how we can live out our own faith in our lives. And so in a way, U2 was like pilgrims when they recorded this album, because they went to Berlin, Germany. And that was the first time they'd ever recorded there. It was a new place for them that way. They're from Ireland. They spent a lot of time in the UK and the US before that. And if you might remember counting back, that was right after the Berlin Wall fell. And so they went into recording this album specifically in Berlin because they thought, here's this uniquely amazing historical event. And so if we go there and we record our music there, it must mean that we'll have this kind of atmosphere of transformation and unity, and it'll just infuse right into our music. But it turned out the opposite was true. They actually fought constantly about whether or not their sound should be influenced by some of the bands that were local to Berlin, and or whether they should keep it more like what had been really, really successful for them in the past. They fought over what type of imagery should make its way into their lyrics. And they just generally were not getting along well as a band at all. And so I remember that now is one of my favorite albums to have gotten. We'll kind of hear the rest of the story later. But they actually came as close as they have ever come to breaking up, thinking, we'll go to this place, it'll almost be magical, it'll make us all feel like we're loving and together, and instead, it almost all turns into a disaster. And it may not seem like the verses that we read this morning, which have, you know, in Acts we heard about the church enjoyed a time of peace. In 2 Kings we hear the story of a widow who has land restored to her, and miracles that God had done through the prophet Elisha are being lifted up. But actually, both of our passages represent times that were even more dramatically fraught and tense and full of struggle and pain and danger. See, at the time that 2 Kings was written, if you read around the chapters of our passage today, you'll see that there are tons of wars going on between Israel and Judah and the countries around them. There's palace intrigue, and other people are trying to rebel against the kings. Kings are dying and being assassinated. There's famine, there's drought, there's suffering. Even for the woman herself who comes into the court, she ends up getting her land restored. But the thing is, she had had to leave her land to begin with because of the drought. She'd gone to a land to be safe, hopefully, that was actually Israel's enemies. The very fact that a woman was coming in to plead to the king rather than her husband. I don't think it mentions in the scripture that she's a widow, but she would have been a widow. Otherwise, the wife at that time would not have come to the king to plead for their land. So there's still all of this pain, all of this suffering, all of this tension that this becomes maybe an island in the middle of, but that the atmosphere for everyone was all of this pain. For the king and Gehazi, they would have been experiencing that kind of at the macro level of all the drama around the country of Israel, but also very personally, the prophet Elisha, if it would come up as being mentioned, was constantly condemning the king for not following God and saying that there would be judgment, that there would be more turmoil, that the king would be replaced by someone else very soon. Gehazi was a former servant of Elisha and was with the king basically because Elisha had sent him away. Gehazi had tried to profit off of one of Elisha's healings of someone else and basically gone back after Elisha had healed this person and said, you know, maybe you should give us a little kickback for all the amazing things that just happened to you. And so Elisha sent him away, actually said that he would get a skin disease as a result of that corruption, and so this is his new life now. Similarly, in the story in Acts that we hear, some of you may recognize Saul being mentioned. This becomes the Apostle Paul. Saul has just had a conversion experience on his way to go and try to arrest, maybe even kill, people who were worshiping Jesus at the time. He was part of the temple authority, and they were not happy that there was sort of this other movement coming up. But he meets Jesus in a vision on the road, decides that he wants to join up with these Christians. But as you would expect, they're being scattered all over the empire because of this persecution from Saul and people like him, constantly under danger, not even able to be in their homes anymore, that they were very suspicious of Saul wanting to come and be around with them. And they were very on edge about all of the suffering and danger that they had been experiencing. And just because they maybe start to figure out how to get along does not mean that it becomes easy or resolved. It even says in the scripture, right, that Saul himself becomes targeted and wanting to be arrested and killed by other people around him. And the rest of the church would continue to experience danger too. And yet, in all these travels that they're all having, in all of these chance meetings that are happening through God leading what's happening, there are these moments of peace, of provision, of unity and reconciliation, even as all sorts of horrible craziness is swirling around outside of all of them. We see that in the story of Acts, Barnabas in particular is a key figure for how Saul and the rest of the Jesus followers are able to be reconciled to each other. Barnabas is mentioned as a Levite, which means that he would have specifically had a job in the Jewish temple. And so he would have had some experience in what is the way that worship should be done. How should God be honored? Should there be a place for these people that are lifting up Jesus as somehow special within the Jewish faith? Maybe he even had times where he was very purity-minded about things needing to only be a certain way and that certain people should be left out. And yet at the same time, he's also a Cypriot, someone from Cyprus, which means that if he's now in Jerusalem, he would have had some of that same pilgrim experience to come from one place to another, to be encountering different types of people, maybe even to have known what it was been like to be told, well, you aren't from Jerusalem proper, you're a Cypriot, so you're probably not as important a Levite as some of the other ones. And so I think perhaps there's a reason why Barnabas is remembered as being called like a son of encouragement and someone who brought regularly throughout the book of Acts Christians who were fighting with each other and having conflict. He was often a means of reconciliation. And I think that we could potentially see that his ability to relate to Paul both from the importance that Paul was holding when he was persecuting Christians with worship and how that should be done a certain way, but also empathizing with Paul as someone who is having a new viewpoint, who might have been excluded otherwise, and learns to both hold up together the importance of worshiping together as community in good values, but also those values becoming ones that are more inclusive, that make more room for people of those different experiences, and that sees God bring them together in important new ways that we might not have seen otherwise if we were only looking at those people that were most like us as being those that God brings us together with. And in the case of the widow, I think that her arrival as a pilgrim back into Jerusalem to meet with the king and to meet with Gehazi reminded them of a time that they saw God's powerful provision, God's love, God's inclusion of people. The first time that Elisha and Gehazi met this woman, she was elderly and childless, wondering about whether her family would have a legacy and a place with their land. But she was very hospitable to Elisha at a time when he was fleeing persecution and danger from the king himself. And so Elisha felt led to say, "I think God is going to give you a son. When I come and see you next year, you will have a child." And it turned out that way, but then the next year again, that child was ill at its deathbed. And the woman went to Elisha and said, "Have you essentially given me this blessing only to have it taken away to break my heart even more than to have no child at all?" But Elisha ended up healing this child. And in fact, it's with its mother, it says in the passage, as she comes back to get her land. So even though there are all these reasons why the king and Gehazi, in encountering Elisha again, could have been suspicious, could have been angry, could have been fearful and distracted by all of the other things that were happening in their lives, I think that there was this moment that said, here's a sign of God being with us, of God providing even in a miraculous way, something that we can take courage and encouragement in, that we can be excited about, and that maybe in particular, we've had our failings. We've done things that we were not supposed to do that even through Elisha, God condemned our actions for. But this reminder of God's goodness inspires us to, at least in this moment, do the right and just thing. Because it would have been really easy for the king to say, "You've been gone for 7 years. You've been actually in the land of our enemies. I have the army. I can just take all that land for myself, leave you with nothing. You bailed on it. It's your own thing." That's not what the law of Israel commanded through God, but that would have been something that might have felt very natural for the king. And instead, we see this moment when the king is willing to be just, even when otherwise he's doing so many things that are condemned. Those pilgrim encounters between people who are going through crazy circumstances gave them moments of clarity and love and reconciliation. As you might expect, the pilgrim forebears that we're also celebrating on this 400th anniversary of the arrival of folks to North America for the first time from England through Holland, they had a lot of their own experiences that way. We've talked a fair amount recently about their encounters with the indigenous people that were already living on North America and how they came in suspicious, but ultimately found that they were able to be helped and have a new sort of community together in partnership, most remembered on the celebration of Thanksgiving that we lift up still in our culture. But there's another partnership with strangers that they had that I think would be interesting to look at today. The pilgrims were not able to fund their own journey to North America, and so they had to get investors. And the investors did not have the same religious convictions that they did. And right before the Mayflower was supposed to leave, the investors told them, "Oh, by the way, we're cramming your ship full of a bunch of other people that you don't know that are also not having your religious convictions, but you have to take them because we're backing your trip." And as you might expect, they were pretty freaked out about that. They thought that they were being jerked around. They felt like all of those people were going to bring God's judgment on them because they didn't believe the same way. We're going to ruin everything, that they weren't going to get along. There was no way that they could possibly have good relationships with any of these people that they called the strangers. But as it turns out, these strangers and the pilgrims, especially through forging an identity together through the struggle of a difficult sea journey, and in particular when over half the people on the Mayflower died in the first winter after they arrived in North America. They found a bond together because those strangers that they were so suspicious of, it turns out, had some of the most important skills for being able to make a new life in North America. Some of them had had a background in going with settlements before. Some of them had other skills that were considered coarse by our very proper pilgrim ancestors, but were very useful in carving out a new life in a new place. And in particular, even whole new families were formed because they cared for each other when all of that death and sickness was happening. And heads of families and brothers and sisters and families were lost, and other people came in to step in and help each other. The way that this was shown most importantly was when the investors, after 2 years, actually pulled all of their money and canceled all shipments of supporting materials to the pilgrims. And so they were desperate and thought, now what are we going to do? And the strangers could have very easily decided, well, they don't have any backing. They didn't like us. We're not necessarily in the same exact religious place as they are. Let's just get on a boat and go back, because this seems way too dangerous. Only one person out of all the strangers did that. All of the rest stayed there and put their lot in instead with our pilgrim ancestors and made sure that as a community that they took care of each other and supported each other and carved out that new life. As I said, with the rest of that story, ultimately you too also found reconciliation and inspiration, even in all of the tension that they had when they were writing this album. One of the most famous songs that came from that and sort of gave the turning point for them, you may be familiar with. It's one of their most famous ones. It's called One. And hearing that, you might think, oh yeah, that's this song about love and togetherness, and so they've just figured out, right, that like, yeah, we're fighting, but you just got to get over it. Remember all the things you have in common, then everything will be fine. Some people even actually like to play this song at weddings a lot. U2 thinks that's bizarre, because if you actually read the lyrics, the theme of oneness and togetherness is much more complicated and difficult than that. It doesn't deny the fact that there's tension and frustration and struggle and even almost coming apart at the seams in relationships regularly. The song itself was awkwardly put together off of pieces of other songs that they didn't like. The lyrics kind of fell into Bono's head, but then they had to continue working on it after that, and even had producers come in and say, yeah, this is a good song with good bones, but we're going to have to keep telling you to try it out this way, try it out that way. It ended up being the song that had a moment of inspiration to get the ball rolling for them, but that took the longest on the album to actually complete. And you can hear in the lyrics the tension that they must have felt in writing it, and also the reminder that they have that oneness does not mean that things are easy or simple or that we just paper over stuff. One section says, did I ask too much, more than a lot? You gave me nothing, now it's all I got. We're one, but we're not the same. See, we hurt each other, and we do it again. However, we can also learn and remember and see in these stories that we're lifting up this morning that when we do stay committed in those difficult times, when we trust that, in fact, our difference and even our tensions can be a blessing and not a curse, it opens up an important way of being creative with those things that we do have. Even if we felt like if I could have a blank check, I'd have something else. But this is what I've got. And then you find that it's good for you. The song actually concludes with the lyrics, one love, one blood, one life. We're not the same. We get to carry each other. They actually end up holding it up as it's a privilege to go through struggle and support each other in that struggle. Even if at the time we know that there might be pain and hurt, even if sometimes we doubt each other, that will actually be a gift to us to go through that together. I think it's a great example of them not sugarcoating things. The same way in our stories, we have these moments of crazy tension and then reconciliation, but it doesn't mean that everything stops being difficult. There was still war and famine in Israel in the 2 Kings passage, even after what happened to the widow. the early church would still go through pain and difficulty and arguments amongst each other and persecution from outside of each other, even though Saul was reconciled into the church and became Paul and wrote so much of our Bible. It's worth remembering that reconciliation isn't only valuable when it's easy or simple or problems stop. In fact, as pilgrims, I think if we stay in that mindset, it helps us see that if we let go of some of our control, if we trust what God is doing with us, if we're gracious with each other, that we can see gifts of creativity that are necessitated by our difficult circumstances. We can see new bonds formed together because of the struggle that we went through. And that we can find new meaning in the future from those moments of reconciliation, because we know that tension and strife and struggle won't stop. And so maybe it makes us better for each new time that we encounter that. I want to mention in particular that it's nice to have our scouts with us today, especially when we're exploring these very themes, because I think you often have examples in the life of scouting that helps you know this and own this for yourselves and can even teach us to some degree. I think just being in a committed organization, trying to work together to live out your values does some of that as well. But I remember a little bit, I didn't go all the way to full Boy Scouts, but in Cub Scouts and doing camping trips, man, if you can't like be on your couch and eating your Oreos and your chips and you got to put up tents and make fires and everything, you know, that is some significant struggle and difficulty. You have to work together on something that is not comfortable, is not part of our normal, natural life. And I would imagine that there have been times when that tent pole is not working exactly the way that you want with the person you're working on, that you are sure it is their fault and they need to get over themselves and do it right, and you are frustrated and angry and ticked off. And yet when it's finally done and you're exhausted and you're sleeping together under that very tent that was causing so much difficulty, and then you're going home and remembering what your time was like, that brought new bonds, that helped you see life in a different way that's valuable to you and the other things that you're doing. And that's that same idea that we're trying to get at from these stories, from our example pilgrims from 400 years ago and from, oh my gosh, so long ago, 30 years with you too, right? See, living with that pilgrim mindset where we're willing to stretch ourselves, where we're willing to be vulnerable and have new encounters, it gives us the chance to see that even in the hardest moments, God is giving us what we need. And often we will be prone to thinking of those things that God is giving us as not what we want, and maybe it even makes it worse. This person that I'm connecting with, they're such a pain. I wish God would get rid of that person and give me the person that I already feel comfortable with and like a lot. This thing that's really difficult, why can't it just be made really easy and God can come in and solve the problem for me and I don't have to have any part of it myself? Right? But it turns out that those people that seem like a hardest fit, those experiences that are the most struggle, can in fact be God's most important gift. Because they are bringing something into our experience that we didn't have before. And how can we grow and stretch ourselves and experience something new unless we have those difficult, uncomfortable, struggling experiences? How will we be equipped to step up to the circumstances around us that are new and different if, in fact, we don't have people with us to help who have different skills and different personalities and different perspectives than what we have? Because if it's new for us and our comfortable skills don't get it done, then maybe it's frustrating to deal with somebody who's different, but we probably need something outside of ourselves to step into something new. And those are God's gift. And so when we're willing to have faith as pilgrims that God can help us make something that's even beyond our own capacity, using the very things that we're suspicious of or uncomfortable with, that's when new ways of life that are full of potential and full of beauty can come about. So now we'll move into a time together where we try a little bit to stretch ourselves, to give of ourselves, and to be mindful of what's around us that God is working in with our tithes and offerings. And so I invite our folks to...